Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this matter is on certiorari to the Second Circuit. It concerns the scope of Section 10B of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, and more particularly, whether it's a violation, a criminal violation of that statute, for a purchaser of stock who was not an insider, I'll put quotes around, and had no fiduciary relation to a prospective seller to purchase that stock without revealing that he had obtained information from a source thoroughly outside the issuer corporation. That is not inside information, but outside information created by the outside source. Mr. Chiarello, the petitioner, was employed in 1975 and 6 as a markup man in Pandic Press, which is a financial printing house in downtown New York. And while there, he came upon, into possession of information from customers of Pandic with respect to their intention to tender for other corporations. And using that information, which he obtained from the customers in his capacity as a markup man, he went into the open market and he purchased shares of stock in the target corporations. He didn't tell anybody he was doing that. He just did it. The issue in this case is whether he had any relationship with the seller of the shares, which would have mandated that he make a disclosure, or whether pure non-disclosure, where there is no fiduciary or other special relationship, amounts to a violation of 10B.
Well, you said there's no special relationship. If an author has written a book and he takes it to a printer to have it printed, and at this stage there's no problem about copyright, do you think there is a special relationship between the printer and the author to take no step that would jeopardize his copyright standing?
I would agree that there is a relationship between the author and the printer, who is an agent of his principal, the printer. But there the remedy would not be something which is analogous to Section 10B. It would be a state remedy, which I think would be most appropriate here.
It wouldn't be covered by this statute, but you said no special relationship. My question was directed at only your statement that there is no special relationship between the customer and the printer.
No special relationship between the seller of the stock in the open market and the printer. There is a relationship of sorts, special, between Mr. Chiarella here, the printer, and the customers of Pandic. But that is not an issue, I say here, though I will deal with that in a moment because the Solicitor General seems to suggest it may have some point. The statute prohibits the employment of any deceptive or manipulative device or contrivance in violation of particular rules which are promulgated by the SEC. Simply put, there has been no deception, no manipulation here within that statute. This is a case of no more than a breach, if you will, of some kind of state fiduciary duty which Mr. Chiarella may have owed the customers of Pandic. If you look at the history of this particular litigation, you'll see a remarkable effort on the part of the district court and then the circuit court and now the Solicitor General to formulate an entirely new theory of relationship in order to impose 10B liability on Mr. Chiarella. In the district court, you had a simple, straightforward, classic insider analysis used.
Where does the concept insider come from? Is there a specific rule under 10B dealing with insiders?
No, the only rule that Congress has ever enacted, Justice Rehnquist, which deals with insiders insofar as trading, is Rule 16B, which mandates that an insider, which is defined in the statute as an officer or a director or a majority, not majority, but controlled shareholder of a corporation, is prescribed from trading, purchasing or selling, or selling or purchasing.
Was your client charged with a violation of the rule under 16?
No, he was not. He was charged with a violation of Section 10B.
Well, then it really doesn't make much difference whether he's an insider or not, does it?
Well, I think the case law. The case law.
The case law. The case law also...
from the Second Circuit.
From the Second Circuit, yes. Yeah. I would say that in this particular case, assuming that Texas Gulf Sulphur and its progeny, or the Katie Roberts case and its progeny, are correct, that it would make all the difference in the world, because my client did not have any statutory or common law fiduciary duty to any of the shareholders in the corporation, the stock of which he purchased. So it does make a difference for that reason.
And Texas Gulf Sulphur is a Second Circuit case.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It is indeed a Second Circuit case. It was the landmark case as of that time on insider trading.
In the Second Circuit.
In the Second Circuit. In that circuit alone. But if you look at what took place in the trial court, the imposition of a classic insider duty on him was thoroughly inappropriate, and it was imposed on the theory that he had no legitimate business purpose in his trade, that is, Mr. Chiarella didn't, whereas the tender offer corporations whom he sought to identify himself with had some legitimate economic purpose. Interestingly, this theory was rejected at the circuit level, and an entirely new effort to push this conduct into 10B was formulated, which has been referred to as the market insider rule. That is, the Second Circuit ruled that since Mr. Chiarella was employed in a printing house which had access to financial information on a regular basis, that regular receipt of information somehow put him into a particular category of status requiring him to disclose or abstain, as the case may be. And of course, somebody in that position would really, if the Court of Appeals were correct, have a duty to abstain. Disclosure would not be something which would be relevant or work at all. That particular test, formulated by the Second Circuit, an entirely new, expansive, novel approach to Section 10B, was rejected in a footnote by the Solicitor General on the grounds that it was insufficiently discreet. That is, that rule would encompass the activities of market professionals and others who perform a worthy market function, and that accordingly that rule wouldn't obtain. And an entirely new rule or rules, again an effort to push this conduct into a particular box, was formulated. The theory which the Solicitor General now advances in its effort to demonstrate some relationship Chiarella had is that by somehow breaching a duty, committing some kind of tort vis-a-vis the tender offeror, the customer of Pandic, that, as if it were a contagious disease, were carried over into the transaction between Mr. Chiarella and the purchaser on the open market. And then secondly, on the other hand, that somehow Mr. Chiarella, by virtue of having the superior information, which he obtained in a, I'm quoting the Solicitor General, a tortious manner, that itself created a direct duty by Mr. Chiarella to the purchaser. Neither one of those theories wash. Neither one of them should stand up to analysis. Simply totally obviate prior law under Section 10B and the common law. With respect to whether or not there is any relevance as to whether Mr. Chiarella did anything to the tender offeror or the customer, of course, that wasn't charged in this case. The case was not indicted that way. It wasn't tried on that theory. It wasn't charged to the jury on that theory. So that's an entirely novel and new approach. But aside from the fact it's not in the case, except at the appellate level, really, there would have been no duty of Chiarella here, because it's a tender, not the tender offeror, it's the customer, the seller of the stock, which 10B is directed at, aimed at. And there was no relationship of Chiarella to that person. And so what happened vis-a-vis the tender offeror, we say, is not relevant at all. Moreover, there was really no fraud there. At most, I think you could say there was an unauthorized use of information, and I would suggest that not all fiducial breaches, not all unauthorized conduct.
Well, his conduct certainly wasn't very appealing to a person of ordinary moral standards. That doesn't necessarily mean it's criminal.
Well, not very appealing, but that's, most respectfully, Justice Rehnquist, hardly a standard to bring within a statute enacted by Congress. No, it was not, but it's a kind of conduct which should appropriately be dealt with by the state with a vast body of state law. He could have been sued in conversion. He could have been fired as it was, sued for breach of contract, or possibly sued under a theory of unlawful acquisition of a corporate opportunity. But it certainly wasn't within 10b, and of course not all unappealing conduct or undesirable conduct is within the common law or statutory meanings of fraud or manipulation.
Your opinion, was it criminal under state law?
Justice Blackmun, under New York state law, I don't believe it was, but there are statutes in other states in this country which would seem to proscribe what is called industrial espionage, that is, taking a secret of an employer and using it for your own benefit. And so possibly in some states it might be deemed criminal. Not in New York, to my knowledge.
You feel fairly certain about that in New York?
I feel very certain here, but I believe so. We've checked the statutes on that and could find no statute which would make his conduct criminal. I suppose that one might attempt to fashion some kind of an unlawful taking from what Mr. Chiarella did, but our analysis of the statutes is such that that couldn't be done. But to be fair, we thought about that. Insofar as Mr. Chiarella's relationship to the seller himself, of course, there was no privity between the two of them. Mr. Chiarella, classically made no misrepresentation. He didn't say a half-truth. He had no duty to that seller. He had no reason, if you will, to have made a disclosure. There's no rule of law that says he must. Now, the Solicitor General does cite an ancient, perhaps not so ancient, but 1870 English case, the Humphrey case, Phillips and Humphrey, which is a sport among the vast body of common law, and a needle in a haystack type case for the proposition that if somehow the superior information was tortiously acquired, it's unfair for a seller to deal with a buyer without making that disclosure. Aside from its sporting nature, the Humphrey case is hardly applicable here in that the tort was inflicted upon the seller in that case, which dealt with a sale of land and the fact that there was coal under the land unknown to the seller. And there was a trespass committed onto the land affecting the seller by the buyer. Not at all apposite. The background of Section 10B and its administrative, its judicial history.
Why isn't the case apposite? You just said it wasn't, but I didn't quite understand your reason why the case wasn't apposite. Why isn't that case like this?
Well, because there was conduct which was directed at the seller, Justice Stevens. There, the buyer had gone onto the land, and he had...
You mean the trespass itself was a tort against the seller?
The trespass itself, and I suspect what happened there in the English court is that in those days when trespass meant somewhat more than it may today, felt that that was something which was a fundamental wrong to the buyer. And so they imported or created for that particular case that kind of duty. To our knowledge, the case, aside from perhaps a law review article or two, has not been used since. I thought it's fair to bring up. It was in the Solicitor General's brief. But if you look at the history of this statute, how it originated, and judicially and administratively, how it's been administered by the SEC, I think you find little or no basis. I shouldn't say little or no, it's giving away too much. You find no basis at all for suggesting that the conduct at issue here is within the statute. To the contrary, I would say that what we have to show shows it's very far outside the ambit of the statute.
Suppose a judge trying a case in the trial court knows that economic consequences are going to have a great impact on the market. Assume, A, he has some stock in the company, and the impact is going to be to push the market down, so he sells. And then alternatively, assume it's going to go up as a result of his holding, and he goes out to the bank and borrows some money and buys a lot of the stock. just the way this fellow did here.
No, I would suggest, Your Honor, it's not what this fellow did, because...
No, I don't mean that...
No, but not even abstractly, not even in principle, because the individual in the hypothetical Your Honor gives is somebody who, in effect, does something to the sellers or buyers of shares in the market. What he does, having, as a judge does, a particular, I would say, a fiduciary obligation to the public as a whole...
Well, I'm assuming that what he is, assume for purposes of my question, that what he does is the correct, not a corrupt decision, a correct decision, but he just takes advantage of the knowledge that he has acquired about the economic consequences.
I would say a judge is a special person, having a special relationship to the public as a whole, not to make use of his...
All right.
Judicial
about,
knowledge or decisions for his own...
How about his secretary?
I would say his secretary would stand in his shoes, but...
The bailiff of the court?
That becomes more difficult the more remote you become, but I would suggest that much as in the typical or standard insider case, if you follow the source of the information. In this particular case, with the judge, I would say he had some kind of an obligation overall... to the community at large, not to self-deal. Now, let me suggest to you that there is still, in my mind, some difficulty in applying Section 10B. I don't know whether the kind of duty which the judge has, which may flow from common law notions of what a judge should do and shouldn't do, and up to the present time when we have specific rules regulating judicial conduct while on the bench in terms of what kind of stocks you can own and not own and how you sell and buy, I don't know whether that would fit within Section 10B. The fact that it's something which may not, to get the point of your hypothetical, appear entirely fair or cricket is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about whether or not conduct falls within a statutory mandate of, is it manipulative or deceptive? Is a manipulative or deceptive device. Now, I say that you don't have anything like that here. The hypothetical Your Honor suggests is one which has certain equities in it, and the question is whether it would fit within the statute, but I don't suggest that... I don't suggest that that's the same at all as our case because of the different status of Chiarella and a judge. Chiarella has no general duty to the public. At most, his duty here would be directed towards his employer and possibly through that to the, well, not possibly, but most certainly through that to the employer's customer.
What did the government rely on, Mr. Arkin, to show that an instrumentality of interstate commerce had been used in this transaction?
Mail.
The offer was made by mail?
Well, the fact that the confirmation slips of the particular, in fact, the indictment list 17 counts in the common way of U.S. attorneys in the Southern District, the number of counts was 17 based upon five interceptions of information, and each one was a separate mailing.
From Mr. Chiarella?
From the broker to Chiarella. That is the confirmation slip on the purchase of stock. Those were the means. Legislatively, this statute, Section 10B, was originally introduced as part of 9C of the 34 Act. And the idea there, if you look at the statute, the way it was originally constituted before it was lifted out of 9C and passed in and of itself by Congress, was to stop manipulation. That is something which artificially affected the price of stocks. Nothing to do with the kind of fact pattern or situation we have here, because certainly whatever Mr. Chiarella did not artificially affect the price of stock on the market. The only inside trading, the only trading on confidential information which Congress dealt with was 16B, which we mentioned a moment ago.
Well, if he had hypothetically been able to borrow enough money and borrowed $1 million, about $1 million worth of stock, it might have an effect on the market.
But not artificially, Your Honor. At most, it would have shoved the price of the stock in the right direction, because the real value of the stock, and that's the point of the case, was the price at which a tender offeror was willing to tender, how much he was willing to pay.
And when you talk about artificial prices, you're talking about pegging, rigging, scalping, and that kind of thing, where you go out and you put some phony information into the market and hope it goes down or goes up, as the case may be. Nothing like that occurred here. If anything, it moved in the right direction. Administratively, too, this particular section has always been considered, say almost always been considered by the SEC, to deal with, in the category of inside information or special information, with somebody who had a fiduciary relationship to the seller of stock, or some special relationship, fiduciary relationship to the issuer of stock.
Mr. Arkin, supposing the tender offeror here had been the issuer, you could have an issuer wanting to buy up a block of its own stock. Would your case be different?
That would be a Texas Gulf case. In Texas Gulf.
No, I'm saying it's still a printer. He's not. It's still a printer, not an insider.
Well, he would be a tippee. He would be a tippee from an issuer corporation, and as such, assuming that he knew that the information came from the issuer corporation.
He was the tippee in the sense he got it. The tippees there got it directly, didn't they, from the directors or office?
Yes, they got it from the issuer corporation.
This man got it through his job at the print shop.
But he got it from a source, not the issuer. There's a fundamental distinction here. You see, the Texas Gulf case...
In other words, are you conceding, let me just be sure I don't lose this point, you're conceding that he would be liable if the seller, if the client of the print shop had been the issuer?
And he had purchased the issuer's share, I'm conceding that under Texas Gulf Sulphur he would fit, yes. Assuming he knew that the information came from the issuer.
But does the wrongfulness of his conduct or the language of the statute draw any distinction at all between the kind of customer of the print shop? Kind of a strange distinction.
The statute itself is a very broad and generic one, much like the mail fraud statute. It doesn't even say that he would be guilty in the hypothetical which Your Honor tenders. But that was engrafted on the law in Texas Gulf, actually before in Katie Roberts.
Are you conceding in a positive to Mr. Justice Stevens' question that Texas Gulf Sulphur was in all respects properly decided?
Oh no, I'm going to deal with that, right now. I don't think that it would be appropriate for me to say it was in all respects proper. At least it's arguable in that Texas Gulf went back to fundamental common law, fiduciary relationship between a corporate officer, director, or control shareholder and the shareholders, which has grown up in this country in the last 40 or 50 years, perhaps most recently or more recently with the Zahn and Transamerica case. Or, said the court in Texas Gulf Sulphur, you might have special circumstances, that is, a special relationship between the seller of the shares and between the buyer of the shares, has been strong and repeated, which was a decision of this court in 1907. But the court in Texas Gulf, the Second Circuit, clearly adopted what has been referred to in the common law as a minority rule, imposing some kind of fiduciary obligation upon a corporate personage, somebody who has some fiduciary relationship to the corporation, and taken that particular minority rule and relationship and carried it into Section 10B. But with our case...
And who's the beneficiary of that, the entire investing public?
Beneficiary of that, Your Honor, depending on what you... Well...
I'm talking about the Texas...
In Texas Gulf Sulphur, the beneficiaries there directly. The parties protected... Let me parse the question. The parties protected are the selling shareholders who have the right to expect, have a confidence in the officers, directors of their corporation.
So it's only the shareholders of the corporation of which the defendants are the insiders.
Well, right? Yes. I mean, in a broad sense, you might say the public interest was protected because the public has an interest in seeing to it that things are done properly and according to law and that faithful allegiances are maintained. But the protected category here under Section 10B quite clearly would be the injured seller, or in an appropriate case, the injured buyer.
Suppose one of the officers of the corporation seeking to make the tender offer individually went... For his own account, went and bought up some of the stock ahead of time. If he made a profit, perhaps his own company could recover it.
Yes.
But how about the selling
stockholder.
I would think that the selling...
He fails to disclose to them that there's about to be a tender offer.
I would think the selling shareholder could recover on the ground. The selling shareholder could claim to be an injured party and that the officer of the issuer corporation...
And this would be true even though the tendering company itself may buy up a limited amount of stock without disclosing anything.
Strike that. I think I missed your question, Mr. Norton. I don't think that the shareholders of the tender offeror would be able to...
The what?
Offeree. You're talking about the offeree corporation?
The target.
I'm talking about an officer of the company that is making the tender offer, the offeror.
Offeror.
He knows about the pending offer.
Yes.
And he goes to some of the stockholders of the target company.
That's right.
He buys it up for some shares for his own account. Has he defrauded those sellers?
He has indeed. They're his shareholders.
Oh, no.
Under...
They are his shareholders.
The tender offeror, I was off something else. The point is no. He would not have a duty to the offeree shareholders. He would not have any duty at all.
Well, he wouldn't have any duty to disclose to them.
No, he would have a duty only to his company, the tender offeror.
Yes, well, that's what I want to know. He wouldn't know a duty to the tender offeree's shareholders.
No, he would not.
Now, if he would not, I suppose... You would argue a fortiori, this printer's employee wouldn't.
Yes, I would argue that. Certainly so. He's a remote tippee.
Well, is the law, has there been some cases like that?
Well, there is.
On an officer of the offeror trading in the shares for his own account?
To my knowledge, not in the shares of the offeree corporation.
And I suppose under the law, the offering corporation itself may acquire some of the shares.
Under the law, under the Williams Act, and before, the tender offeror, under the Williams Act, the tender offeror can now acquire up to 5% without making a disclosure under the Williams Act.
And that is not thought to be a fraud on anybody.
No, indeed.
And how about before the Williams Act?
In 1968, Judge Friendly, prior to the Williams Act being enacted, said that we know of no rule of law applicable at the time, referring to prior to the Williams Act, which was about to be enacted, that a purchaser of stock who was not an insider or had no fiduciary relationship to a prospective seller had any obligation to reveal circumstances that might raise a seller's demand. So that as of 1968, it was very clear that there was no such obligation.
Yeah, but under my brother White's question, he is an insider of the Offeror Corporation, and he uses that inside information. Based on that inside information, i.e. of a forthcoming takeover attempt by his corporation, he goes to shareholders of the target corporation and buys their shares. Because of his inside information, he has every reason to believe that the price of the shares is going to go up.
That would undoubtedly be something which the tender offeror, could claim against him in a suit for...
Well, let's assume he could, but could the selling stockholders of the offeree get to him?
No way. No way. There's no
using inside information.
Inside, not to the target corporation, not to the issuer. It's very different. He owes no duty, if you will, to the selling shareholder. Now, what you're doing is taking the category insider, which itself, may not be the most accurate term or label, insider in one place and importing it to another place.
Your insider is my outsider, in other words.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And I suppose if the printer had breached his contract and just decided to publish, he's printing, but he decides it'd be a hot item to announce to the press, so he just announces it. He probably might be liable in damages to the offeror, but he probably wouldn't have violated 10B, would he?
I think that's exactly right, and that's a very fine hypothetical to test what we are presenting to this court here. And the point is that had Vincent Chiarella, for example, say, gone to the target company and said, let me sell you some information you'd like to have, why, that would not have been a violation, clearly, of Section 10B. It would have been some kind of contractual or perhaps conversion breach.
The reason, of course, I suppose, it would not have been in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. That would be... But the thing that puzzles me a little bit, we seem to be coming to the conclusion that your client may have defrauded the customer of the printer, the tender offeror, but not the person that he bought the stock from. But even if that conclusion is correct, why isn't it still true that he committed a fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of a security?
Well, because...
Even though the defrauded party is a different party than the person from whom he bought the security.
Well, that is one of the themes of the Solicitor General, and I suggest to you that in connection with means a fraud directed at the transaction, something which is intended to visit injury upon the seller or purchaser of shares. That didn't take place here.
Do you think it may be that the blue chip and all the rest in essence hold that the wrongdoer must defraud the other party to a transaction? There's a lot of 10B cases that don't fit that mold, aren't there?
Well,
I'm wrong. I just...
There are 10B cases which may, depending on the standing issue, come up a somewhat different way, but basically all of the cases involved have to do with imposing a sanction upon somebody who is directing his fraud, his misconduct towards a purchaser or buyer of shares.
What about C, subparagraph C, which reads, to engage in any act, practice, which operates or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon any person. It doesn't limit it to any particular person.
But this is an...
In connection with the purchase or sale of any security. Now, he has engaged in a purchase or sale of a security, hasn't he?
Yes, but his conduct was not directed at the seller in this particular case.
Anything in that language that says it must be directed at the seller?
Well, this court, if you will, in blue chip seemed to suggest that very strongly, adopting the Birnbaum rule out of the Second Circuit. Moreover, I should say to Your Honor, I know my time is up, that this was not the theory on which this case was tried. It wasn't indicted that way. And that if for some reason this court were to find that any conduct directed to tender offeror fitted into a category of 10B violation, that would run afoul, I suggest, of Ruiz and Bowie in those cases which call for fair notice.
Very well, Mr.
Isn't that argument you just made applicable to the arguments that the Solicitor General's made that are different from those made below?
Yes, I think that the fact that different arguments have been made and rejected by the government at various levels certainly does go to that point. Yes, the fact is there was a deprivation of due process here if through some new novel interpretation of Section 10B it's found that Mr. Chiarella had some liability under that statute. That would have to be prospective.
Their evidence, I hate to go over your time this way, but their evidence on this point was confined to the people who had who had sold the stock to Chiarella. They all got on the stand and said, I wouldn't have sold if I'd been told, isn't that what?
Yes, they did. The court instructed the case out that way, and the summation of the prosecutor, except for one line, was all towards the vast injury suffered by these sellers. Yes.
Thank you. Very well. Mr. Shapiro?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 forbid the use of deceptive devices in connection with the purchase of securities. The central question presented in this case is whether petitioner used such a deceptive device. We contend that his use of converted non-public market information to enrich himself in the stock market without disclosure to anyone was a deceptive device within the prohibition of the statute and the rule. In establishing this proposition, we look first to the duties which petitioner owed to the tender offerors whose information he converted. We then consider the duties which petitioner owed to public investors. We begin with the fact, which was admitted on the witness stand, that petitioner misappropriated confidential information belonging to the tender offerors and used that information to purchase securities at a large personal profit.
Because Mr. Shapiro, may I just throw one question at you that you cover before you get through? Supposing one can argue that it was the seller who was defrauded, or one can argue it was the tender offeror that was defrauded. Either way, assume you had an action in which the defendant came in and said, well, I know I cheated somebody. I'll pay the money into court, and you two fight it out as to who's entitled to this money. Who would get it? That is, between the tender offeror and the people who sold to him.
The SEC's consent decrees in this area have made the restitution first to the public investors, and if they can't be identified, then to the tender offerors whose information has been converted. The priority has been given to the investors.
But assuming there's got to be a choice, you'd say the investor would get it even though the tender offeror could have made precisely the same transaction with the investor.
Well, the tender offeror is
could have separately say he doesn't have up to 5%. He could have gone to the sellers and said, "I'll buy this amount of stock at this very same price that this person did."
That case is not only a distinguishable one; it's antithetical in our view. The tender offeror makes an investment decision on the basis of publicly available information. He doesn't steal, he doesn't convert, or he doesn't embezzle.
Well, he doesn't. The information he's about to make a tender offer isn't publicly available.
That's internally generated information gotten through bona fide business activity. Well, it's not stolen information.
It's the epitome of inside information.
But inside information in the cases that have come up thus far can't be misused in situations where it's been misappropriated, where there's conversion or theft or misappropriation. This is the triggering circumstance that gives rise to the duty of disclosure. And that's how we distinguish that case from the present case.
Well, inside information has to be fitted in with some portion of Rule 10b-5, doesn't it, which doesn't say anything about inside information.
That's correct. We rely on subsection A and subsection C, which deal with devices, schemes, or artifices to defraud, or practices which operate as frauds. This court held in the affiliated Ute case that total silence when there's a duty to disclose can be a device to defraud. It held the same thing in the capital gains case, and that was the rule of common law. When there was a duty to speak, total silence was a device to defraud.
Well, the issue here, I suppose, ultimately is, was there a duty to disclose?
There was a duty to disclose here.
I mean, that's the issue, isn't it?
It is indeed. To the tender offerors and to the public investors. I'd like to begin with the tender offerors and explain why there was a duty to disclose to them.
Wasn't there also a duty to disclose to the tender offeror? Didn't Chiarella owe a duty to his principal?
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. It was a double failure to disclose in connection with a securities transaction. An agent or other fiduciary who plans to make personal use of confidential information that's entrusted to him has an unqualified duty to make prior disclosure to his principal before using that information. At common law, failure to make disclosure to the principal was a form of deceit. To be sure, it was a breach of fiduciary duty, but it was something more because there was a failure to disclose and a duty to disclose. Secret misappropriation is different from unfairness or negligence in the discharge of a fiduciary duty. Under black letter legal principles, it's a garden variety type of fraud or deception. Petitioner's scheme to enrich himself by using this confidential information was carried on through stock transactions. In this case, as in the Banker's Life case, a stock transaction was the vehicle for a fraudulent misappropriation. In Banker's Life, the defendant engaged in a securities transaction and afterwards converted the proceeds of the sale. Because that conversion was in connection with a securities transaction, this court held that it violated Section 10B and Rule 10b-5. Section 10B, we would point out, is not limited to frauds that injure investors. As this court held last term in the Naftalin case in construing the parallel anti-fraud rule in the 33 Act, the anti-fraud provisions that are phrased in general terms reach frauds practiced on any person.
To whom was this duty to disclose owed, as you're now positing it? To the person he bought the stock from?
The first duty that we deal with is the duty owed to the tender offerors. There was a duty to disclose to them prior to his misappropriation of their confidential information. Disclose that he was about to deal on his own behalf or in his own interest with their confidential property.
That he was about to misappropriate it.
That's a black letter rule of agency, and it's a black letter rule of the common law of fraud. And we rely on that in connection with the tender offerors.
Shares on the New York Stock Exchange.
He had to disclose that he was about to use their information to purchase shares New York Stock Exchange. That was the omission. And it's conceded that he made no such disclosure to these tender offerors before converting their information.
He made no disclosure of any kind, did he?
No disclosure of any kind.
But just so I may be clear, your submission is he should have disclosed what?
He should have disclosed to the tender offerors that we're dealing with first that he was about to misappropriate confidential information entrusted to them to purchase stock on the New York Stock Exchange.
And that. There were two separate disclosures then. And that he was going to use this.
Both things had to be disclosed as a matter of agency law and as a matter of the common law fraud.
And well, so then your basic submission really is that the criminal provisions of the SEC make any violation of an agency principal relationship into a crime.
Not at all. Only when there's a failure to disclose or a misrepresentation in connection with a breach of fiduciary duty is there a 10b-5 violation. That's the holding in the Green case, and we think that's a correct analysis. And in this case, there was a failure to disclose where there was a duty to disclose. And under the Green case, that can be a violation of Section 10b. That's the analysis we rely on here. It doesn't matter that the victims of this scheme, when we look at the tender offerors, weren't purchasers or investors. The blue chip stamps rule is a rule of standing in private damage actions. It isn't applicable in a government enforcement proceeding. In a government proceeding, all that the government need show is that a deceptive device was used in connection with the purchase of securities. The identity of the victim is simply irrelevant. That was the holding in Naftalin, and it's equally applicable here.
You think that criminal statutes should be more broadly construed than civil statutes?
The statute should be given its literal interpretation. That's all we're contending for, that it reaches any fraudulent device used in connection with a securities transaction, not limited to particular kinds, not limited to transactions that injure particular categories of victims. It covers any fraudulent scheme.
How about the officer of the tender offeror who uses his inside information to go out and trade on his own account, just like this printer did?
He violates Section 10b. Mm-hmm. The case of SEC versus Shapiro from the Second Circuit held that persons who misappropriate information from the acquiring company and use that information to buy the target stock violate the rule.
Do you think in that case the seller of the stock from whom he buys could recover damages from him under 10b?
Well, the question of who can recover in a private action is an unsettled area. There is divergence among the courts on that.
I'm not asking you how much. I'd just like to ask you whether a legal duty to the seller of the stock has been breached.
There has been a breach of legal duty to that seller. If that seller can be identified.
Under 10b?
Yes, that is correct. That was
because there was a duty to disclose?
There's a duty to disclose.
Where do you get that out of 10b?
Whenever misappropriated information is used in the stock market and it's material and non-public, there's a duty to disclose. This has been the SEC's position.
Why does it have to be misappropriated?
Well,
what if it's just confidential?
If it's information, non-public market information generated through bona fide business activity with no element of misappropriation, none of the case law yet has held that brings you into the area of fraud.
What if this printer had gone out and just told everybody what he knew? He didn't go out and misappropriate it in the sense that he profited by it. He just went out and blabbed it all over town. A lot of other people started buying shares.
Well, telling the truth is not a violation of Section 10b because it's not deceptive. It's not a fraud.
But he did spread around confidential information. That's not enough.
Well, no, if
even though he breached his contract and breached his fiduciary duty to his principal.
That's correct. You need deception or non-disclosure to come within the scope of Section 10b. That's why Your Honor's hypothetical is not a 10b violation, although it's a wrong to the tender offerors.
Does he need to profit by it himself?
No, he doesn't. The element of profit is irrelevant. If he uses a deceptive device in connection with a stock transaction, and he does so willfully, and the mails are used, the government's case is complete. Personal profit is not an element of the crime.
Shapiro, may I ask this question? Do you read the opinion of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals as requiring some special relationship, fiduciary relationship? It seems to me it says, and here I quote from it, a test of regular access to market information appears to us to provide a workable rule.
The court does appear to adopt a rule of regular access to non-public information.
But you don't go that far.
We don't go that far for the reasons that are discussed in the amicus curiae brief of the Securities Industry Association. Many legitimate businesses obtain non-public market information in the course of their business activities. The specialist on the New York Stock Exchange floor does this. And because there's no element of misappropriation or conversion, the cases have not interpreted this kind of activity as a violation of the statute.
What about the investment analyst that pays a visit to a corporation and obtains more current estimates of earnings for the year than are available generally? Then that analyst advises his clients to buy. Has he violated 10b-5?
Yes, the theory that's been applied in these cases is that the leaking of the confidential information to this individual is a misappropriation or a misuse of confidential corporate information that shouldn't be available for the personal use of anyone. That's a wrong to the company. And if he thereafter uses it for personal profit, that's a violation of Section 10b.
You're saying if a corporate executive gives any information to an analyst who visits him that isn't public and that may arguably affect the influence of the stock, and that information subsequently is used, that both the executive, I guess he's a tipper, and the investment advisor is a tippee,
That's essentially correct. If the information is material, confidential information that hasn't been disclosed to the rest of the analysts and the rest of the investors in the market.
Where do you get that out of either the statute or the rule?
That's been the consistent interpretation of the SEC since the Katie Roberts case and every court that's considered.
You're not arguing to the Second Circuit now.
This court approved that rule in the case of Foremost versus McKesson. It said that misuse of inside information by insiders is a violation of Section 10b. It said that in the course of its analysis of Section 16b of the Act.
But
this court has approved that analysis.
Terms like misuse, misappropriation seem to me to be quite loosely used by the government here.
It's a violation of legal duty. That's what we mean by misuse. If this information is taken for the personal benefit of an employee of the company and used in the stock market, that's a wrong against the company.
How do you decide whether there's a legal duty or not? Is it state law or federal law?
It's ultimately a question of federal law whether there's a violation, but you look to state law to determine if there's a duty to keep this information confidential. State
and you
law
say
is the springboard.
In response to Justice Powell's question, therefore, whether there was a duty on the part of the corporate president to not disclose to the analysts would depend on the law of the 50 states?
Well, the law in the 50 states is consistent on this point. An agent that has confidential information of its principal, in your hypothetical, the company, can't misuse that and can't leak it to other persons. That's a violation of his duty under black-letter agency rules. It isn't a matter of various rules under different state jurisdictions. It's a settled principle of agency law.
But the difficulty is, as a practical matter, that corporate executives wouldn't know whether information was material or not, in the sense that a jury perhaps might decide. You talk about your company, you talk about it all the time, and the country is full of analysts and investment advisors who try to understand what's going on in corporations.
The courts have wrestled with this difficulty, and one of the safeguards against improper prosecutions or improper civil damage judgments is the scienter requirement. This has to be done with an element of mens rea or scienter. It can't be done innocently or even negligently.
I think the point made in this case by your colleague is that there's no proof of intent in this case. Intent to defraud.
The district court charged the jury that it couldn't convict unless it found engagement in a device to defraud knowingly, intentionally, and willfully, with realization that it was wrongful, with an understanding that this was wrongful conduct.
What was the device in this case?
It was failure to disclose to the tender offerors, A, and B, failure to disclose to public investors that stolen information was being used in transactions with them.
Right. I understand, of course, that there was a failure to disclose. The question in my mind is whether the man on the street would construe that as a device or a scheme or an artifice. They're the statutory words, and we have a criminal case, which is what concerns me.
I have no doubt that the
I don't
man...
I don't defend what this fellow did.
I have no doubt that the man on the street would say that someone that steals information that's non-public and uses that to exploit a seller in the stock market is guilty of a cunning device. If this isn't a new cunning device,
precisely.
Have you got some independent grounds for this? Even if he didn't owe a legal duty to the seller,
he owed a duty to those tender offerors, and that's a ground.
Even if he breached no duty to the seller, he did breach a duty to the offerors in connection with his purchase of the security.
That's quite correct.
And that's all as far as you need to go.
Well, we agree that the court could affirm on that narrow ground. That is correct. But we
usually try to affirm on the narrowest ground possible?
Well, that is a possibility. But we think that both of these theories are integrally related and that they both have a clear basis in prior law, and we would...
But if you include the latter and say if you said you had to have a breach of duty to the seller, it seems to me you have some problem about permitting the corporation itself to purchase shares without disclosure of the facts. I know you don't think so, but it seems to me that certainly before the Williams Act, it had been held that the offeror could go out and purchase shares without disclosing.
That's quite true. Information...
And there was no breach of duty.
That's because there was no embezzlement or conversion in obtaining that information.
That's just restating your conclusion.
Well,
Mr. Shapiro, the
information is generated within the corporation through honest methods. There's no way to characterize that as dishonest. I know, but there's no disclosure.
I'm talking about the duty to the seller. There's no disclosure whatsoever, although the corporation knows it's going to make a tender offer.
Well, that's correct. And at common law, there wasn't a duty to disclose when information was gotten honestly. And that's the principle we rely on here.
Well,
and that's been the principle that the SEC and the courts have used under Section 10B. As early as 1943, the SEC concluded that misappropriated non-public market information couldn't be used in the stock market to take advantage of uninformed investors. That's one of the earliest cases under Section 10B. The Second Circuit, in the Shapiro case, held that you couldn't convert information from the acquiring company and use that information to buy the shares from the target company shareholders. This principle...
Excuse me for interrupting, right? But all of these cases are civil cases. How many criminal prosecutions have there been under 10b-5?
We have collected some of them in a footnote.
How many prior to this case?
Criminal cases, I would say the number is between 20 and 30. They're collected in Professor Loss's treatise, and we cited
some of them. Have they been prosecuted to conclusion?
A number of them have, which we've cited in our brief.
With convictions?
With convictions, mm-hmm. With appellate court
opinions. Under 10b-5.
That's correct.
Do you remember where they're cited? In some footnote, I think.
It is indeed a footnote in our brief.
It's a long brief. I just looked for it.
I was under the impression that the dissenting judge on the Court of Appeals said that there never had been a criminal prosecution under 10b-5. Did he say that?
What he had in mind is that there has never been a criminal prosecution for misuse of inside information. He didn't mean to suggest that there's never been a criminal prosecution for various other kinds of misconduct in connection with a stock transaction, because there have been dozens of those.
But never a criminal case like this.
Well, there is one case that has some similarity to this that we've cited. It's the Hancock case, where non-public information about an acquisition of a mutual fund was misappropriated by an employee, and that information was used to purchase up the stock. And this was the subject of an indictment and a guilty plea in New York. That's the only case that fits this exact factual pattern that came up in a criminal context.
Judge Maskell said... We have been cited no case in which criminal liability for 10B non-disclosure has been imposed on any purchaser of stock, either inside or outsider.
Well, that case was not cited in the Second Circuit. We've included in our brief in this court. I would like to speak directly to the point of fraud on the sellers of these securities.
Just before you leave your point of fraud on the... of the customer.
Yes, Your Honor.
One can agree readily with you that it was a breach of some sort of a fiduciary duty for him not to disclose to the customer corporation that he had acquired this information as an employee of the printer. But how freely translatable is a breach of a fiduciary duty into something that's fraud or deception or misrepresentation?
That's an important question after this court's Green decision, because it has to be non-disclosure as opposed to simple unfairness.
Now, there has to be reliance to the detriment.
No reliance.
Non-disclosee.
If I may say, in a government enforcement proceeding, there is no requirement of proof of injury to a private person. Simply,
yeah, but fraud means misrepresentation upon which there's reliance to the detriment of the person to whom the misrepresentation has been made.
The definition is suppression of the truth to take advantage of another person. That's the definition that was used in the charge to the jury. And here the suppression of truth was in failing to disclose to the tender offerors that this self-dealing was occurring, where there was a duty under established black-letter principles to make that
disclosure.
A fiduciary duty.
And then how is breach of a fiduciary duty so freely translatable into a misrepresentation or deception or fraud?
Well, as the court in the Green case pointed out, if there is a duty to disclose and a failure to disclose, mm-hmm. that's a fraud. It's a form of misrepresentation. That's what this case, this court held in the Green case.
That could follow as between strangers, but it might not carry over where you're talking about a breach of a fiduciary duty, which is a stricter standard.
Well, if the fiduciary duty requires disclosure and there's non-disclosure and it's in connection with the securities transaction, that's a 10b-5 fraud.
Well, but I don't see that follows necessarily. It could follow, but it need not necessarily follow.
That's what this court held in the capital gains case, and it held that in Affiliated Ute. When there was a fiduciary duty to make disclosure, and there was a failure, a complete silence on the part of the defendant, that was a deceptive device.
Now, Mr. Shapiro, what if the fiduciary duty had been obeyed here, and there had been a disclosure?
To the tender offerors.
To the tender offeror. The sellers on the stock market wouldn't have known anything about that, would they?
Well, in that case, you'd have to address the question of whether failure to disclose is...
presumably that wouldn't have been thereby public knowledge, would it?
That's correct. It could well be a fraud on the sellers of the securities, even though it wasn't a fraud on the tender offerors.
Why would it have been a fraud? Where would have been their loss?
Well, in a government enforcement proceeding, it isn't necessary to show that there is private loss. But the...
Well, that's the definition of fraud, though, the common law definition. There has to be... detriment, doesn't there?
Well, this court held in capital gains that there doesn't have to be proof of private loss in a government enforcement proceeding, and the lower courts have all held that under Section 10B. That is not an element under Section 10B. The crime is complete when there's proof of a deceptive device in connection with a stock transaction, use of the mails, and mens rea. That's the entire case.
Well, but somebody else has got to be involved. People don't write letters and just drop them in the dead letter
gutter.
Well, there have been prosecutions in cases very similar to that, where a false prospectus may be misdelivered and that it causes no harm to anyone. But the convictions are sustained uniformly because there has been deceptive conduct in connection with a stock transaction. It doesn't have to be effective. It doesn't have to be completed and cause injury to a private party. That is not an element of the offense.
Mr. Shapiro, I have not read the instructions to the jury, but to what extent in those instructions was there emphasis placed on the tender offeror as the party to whom the duty of disclosure was owed? I thought the case was tried on the other theory.
It was tried throughout on two theories. In the indictment, it was charged the petitioner's scheme was a fraud on the sellers, and then secondly and independently that it was a device, scheme, or artifice to defraud without limitation on the victims. And in the court's pretrial decision...
Well, without limitation, but did they specifically say it was that the tender offeror was defrauded?
Well, the defendant moved for dismissal of the indictment, and the district court held that both kinds of fraud were encompassed by this language in the indictment, and that it could be a fraud both on the tender offerors and a fraud on the sellers. And that's how the case was argued to the jury. It was argued as a fraud on the tender offerors and on the sellers. Both theories were presented, and there was no question of surprise to the defendant, because the district court held as its first ground for sustaining the indictment that this conduct was a fraud on the tender offerors. Both of these elements have been in the case throughout the litigation.
It was, because the Second Circuit certainly didn't rely on that theory at all.
The Second Circuit relied principally on fraud on the sellers, although it affirmed on this alternative ground as well. It didn't give the same play to it that the district court had.
Well, could the jury have decided it on either ground, was the jury required to find that there was fraud on both the
jury offerors? The jury could find on either ground. That's correct. That's how the case was argued. I would emphasize to the court that as early as 1943, the SEC had held that it's a violation of Section 10B to convert confidential market information and use that information to exploit uninformed investors. That's the Hanahan case cited in our brief at page 59. The commission has also held that inside corporate information can't be misused in the stock market, but none of the commission's decisions or the decisions of any court suggests that Section 10B is limited to inside information frauds.
Mr. Shapiro, let me ask you just one more. I'm really embarrassed by this. But anyway, would you concede that under Blue Chip, the tender offeror could not have recovered damages from the defendant?
Well, I wouldn't concede that because the tender offerors did purchase securities. And if, in fact, they could prove injury in connection with those securities in their capacity as purchasers, they would have standing to sue under Blue Chip.
But just out of this particular, say they had engaged in no purchase transaction just because they failed, just because there was a breach of duty to them, they could not recover damages just out of these five transactions.
That's correct. Okay. If they were not purchasers, defrauded as purchasers, they wouldn't have standing to sue under Blue Chip. This court's decision in the affiliated Ute case in 1972 held that use of undisclosed market information to exploit uninformed investors can violate the statute. That wasn't a case involving insiders. That was a case involving outsiders with market information. And the Second Circuit, in the Shapiro case that I've referred to, held that the same principle applies to an acquiring company, officer, or consultant who misappropriates confidential information and uses that information to take advantages of sellers in the stock market.
I'm going to have to go back then. I gather, though, before there's a breach of duty to the sellers, there has to be a misappropriation of information.
That's correct.
So you do have to find both elements. You have to find some wrong to the tender offeror.
Well, that's correct.
It really aren't two independent grounds. Wouldn't say a fellow who was eavesdropping at lunch one day and heard some inside information, he wasn't connected with anybody, he just heard it. He went out and purchased on the market and made the same profit as this man did, he would not have violated 10B.
Without some element of misappropriation or wrongfulness in receiving the information, that tippy isn't liable. He has to realize that it's non-public, and he has to realize that it's gotten through some improper means before a tippy is responsible.
So just a wrong to the sellers alone would not violate 10B.
Just using information without some
non-disclosure to the sellers wouldn't violate 10B.
That's quite correct.
Unless you went on and showed that the information was wrongfully obtained and being wrongfully used.
That's correct. That's correct.
Shapiro, your argument, as I understand it, turns on there being a relationship, however one might describe it. In Ute, as I understand it, there was what would normally be regarded as a relationship of trust. There's a bank involved, transfer agent or trustee. In this case, you had a man who had access to information. He would not normally be viewed as a trustee. You've used the word fiduciary. He may have been sort of a sub-agent. Pandick perhaps was an agent for a purpose. But you carry that thought along. You have office boys in law firms, for example. You have the cleaner who comes into an office firm at night and who is smart enough to do what this gentleman did. Do you go all the way down the line to anybody who sort of picks up information, regardless of how tenuous the relationship may be?
Well, our position is that stolen, embezzled, or converted information can't be used in the stock market under any circumstances. Under the situations that you pose, if someone picked up a piece of paper without realizing what it was in a random way, that certainly wouldn't be a violation. But if a secretary or a paralegal working on a tender offer prospectus were to take this information and knowingly use it, and realizing that this was wrongful conduct, that would be a violation. It would indeed. These people are entrusted with confidential information, and they have a fiduciary duty to tender offer oars. That principle is, it's a principle of agency. When there's an entrusting and a violation of that trust, there's a duty to disclose to the tender offerors before misappropriating their information.
But the cleaning woman who was smart enough to understand the situation, who didn't work for the law firm, but who did pick up not just one piece of paper, but who picked up drafts of prospectuses or tender offers, what category would she fall in?
I would say that in that situation you would have theft rather than embezzlement. There hasn't been an entrusting of information to the cleaning woman, but if she realizes that she's stealing something that belongs to someone else, that can't be used in the stock market. Mm-hmm. The commission discussed this at some length in the investors' management decision, where it held that getting information through burglary or commercial espionage is an improper way to get information to exploit investors in the stock market.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Army Board of Directors will tomorrow at 10 o'clock.